The Destiny Foundation presents Rabbi Beryl Wein's Travels Through Jewish History. This, the 27th tape in the series, is entitled Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, delivered August 14th, 1985. We hope you enjoy.
The golden age of the Jews in Spain can be symbolized by one person. That one person is probably the greatest person that the Jewish people produced from the time of the Talmud till our day. And that is the great Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon, Maimonides the Rambam. And it is not an exaggeration almost that the epitaph on his grave is Mimoshe ad Moshe lokom kemoshe, that from Moses to Moses there arose none like Moses. Meaning that the Rambam in his time and in his day and in his influence on the Jewish people approached the influence of our great teacher Moses. The Rambam marks the high point of Spanish Jewry, the zenith. From the time of the Rambam on, it will be downhill. Downhill politically, economically, socially, every way possible. And in fact, during the life of the Rambam, we already see the clouds that gather over the Jews who live in Spain. I want to therefore discuss the life of the Rambam, a biographical sketch. In order to do him some sort of justice, we would have to spend a number of lectures, but the exigencies of time and of tape don't allow us that. But nevertheless, I do want to attempt to give you a flavor of the person and of what he represented and of the monumental effect that he continues to have on Jewish life and Jewish thought. The Rambam was born in Cordova in the year 1135. His father, Rabbi Maimon, was a dayan, a judge in the Jewish community in Cordova, and the Rambam traces his family back to the family of King David, a royal lineage of the house of Judah. The Rambam, for the first 15 years of his life, was raised in his father's home. And to a great extent, his father was his main teacher. His other teacher, whom he mentions, was the great Rabbeinu Yosef Ibn Megash, the Re-Megash, Rabbi Joseph from the city of Gash, G-A-S-H, and the Rabbeinu Yosef Ibn Megash was the last disciple of Rabbi Yitzchok Alfasi, of the Rif. So that the Rambam, in effect, is only one generation removed from the Rif in terms of halachic tradition, even though in terms of age and chronology, he is almost 150 years after the birth of the Rif. But as I mentioned to you, the Rif lived a very long time. He lived more than 100 years. And the Re-Megash was a young man who studied with the Rif when the Rif was an old man. And the Rambam was 15 when he studied with the Re-Megash, who was already an old man. So that's how it can happen that you have a long span of time chronologically, but in terms of tradition, in terms of halachic tradition, it is a only one generation removed. That's very important to remember because the grounding of the Rambam is in the tradition of the Rif, who was the first of the great authors of halachic works in Spain. When the Rambam was 15, the Rambam, by the way, writes about his Rebbe, about the Re-Megash. He says, when I think of how much that man knew, he says, I have a headache. My head hurts. how much his Rebbe, the Rimage, if the Rambam writes that about the Rimagash, so one can have some inkling of what kind of people we are talking about. It would be superfluous to say that the Rambam was blessed with a superior mind, with a photographic memory, with a tremendous willpower to study, so that he himself writes that by the time he was 15, he had acquired a complete education. And when he means a complete education, he means not only a complete Torah education. The Rambam was, if we could use that term, the Rambam is the original Renaissance man. The Rambam is a philosopher, an astronomer, a mathematician, a physician, a linguist, a poet, a critic, and it's all self-taught. Now, it's hard for us in our day of medical schools and internship and residencies and specialties and subspecialties to imagine a self-taught doctor, though there may be some lurking out there today also. Someone once told me that he attended Yale Medical School. In Yale Medical School, you don't have to go to any of the classes. You just have to take the test. She said he never came the whole year, came, took the test, and passed. I immediately got a different doctor. Because he may have got a 70. I don't know what he got, right? But our concept of a self-taught doctor is, it's very difficult for us to appreciate that. But the truth of the matter is that almost until our time, medicine was not the exact science, quote-unquote, that it holds itself out to be today. And that the study of anatomy and of medicine and of pharmacology, etc., especially in the Middle Ages, was almost completely self-taught. And we will find that that's true with the Rambam, and that's true with other great Jewish rabbis who also were physicians, that they taught themselves medicine. But by the time he was 15, the Rambam felt that he had a complete education. At the age of 15, an event occurred that would have tremendous bearing not only on the life of the Rambam, but on Jewish history in Spain. The Muslim religion, like many other religions, goes through certain cycles. The cycles are between the liberals, if one could use that word, or the moderates, and between those who are what are today called fundamentalists. In other words, there are Muslims who for a long period of time don't take the Quran literally, and may not even take it too seriously. And then there comes a period of time when the Quran is taken not only seriously, but literally. In our time, examples of that abound. Gaddafi in Libya, Khomeini in Iran, the ruling family in Saudi Arabia. Those are people who take the Quran literally. Head of Iraq, for instance, he's not really Froom. He doesn't really believe it. He's more socialist than Muslim. Assad in Syria. And the Muslim world swings almost like a pendulum, back and forth between extremes. And when the swing does occur, that is a dangerous time, again, as our time has proven. It's a time of fanaticism, a time of cruelty, and there is no cruelty equal to the cruelty perpetrated in the name of God. Because then there are no inhibitions. Then one is allowed to destroy human life without compunction, not only without compunction, with the expectation of reward because of the fact that what he is doing is holy. In Spain, for the first 200 years that the Jews were there, from the middle of the 10th century to the middle of the 12th century, the Moors and the Muslims did not take Islam very seriously. Therefore, they were tolerant of Jews. They were easygoing in matters of religion. And even though the time itself was a cruel time in the world, and the punishments for even minor crimes were horrific, and nevertheless, there was a spirit of liberalism, almost easygoing type of life in Spain. In the year 1150, a sect of Muslims called the Almohads, those who are devoted to Muhammad, this sect, a fundamentalist sect believing in the literal interpretation of Islam and of the Quran, staged revolutions throughout Spain. And the revolutions were against the easygoing Muslim sheikhs and caliphs who were running the country. And they demanded a strict interpretation and a strict enforcement of all the laws of the Quran. Since the Quran in many, many areas is self-contradictory, and in other areas it is vague, this really meant that they could do whatever they wanted to, all in the sake of heaven. And in the year 1150, they were successful in gaining control in the city of Cordova, in the Rambam's home city, where he and his family lived. And one of their first acts was to force the Jews of Cordova to convert to Islam. And after a great deal of influence, pressure, bribery, whatever word we want to use, they allowed the Jews of Cordova a short period of time to make up their mind. Those Jews that did not want to make up their mind left. But leaving meant that you left your home, you left your furniture, you left your business. For all intents and purposes, you left your wealth, whatever you had, except for what could be taken with you. Those Jews that sought to have the best of all worlds and somehow to ride out the storm remained in Cordova and converted to Islam. Later, when the Almohads would fall, as they would, within a decade, almost all the Jews reverted back to Judaism. But then the question arose whether or not they were to be accepted back, and if accepted back, under what terms. We'll see that the Rambam himself will play a role in gaining the acceptance of these Jews back into the fold. And that even though he could have said, as many other Jews who fled Cordova did say, listen, we gave up everything to retain our Judaism. And these guys could not pass the test. Now they want to come, you know, they want to have Maftar Yonah and Yom Kippur, not by us. But we'll see that the Rambam was above such an attitude. And the Rambam generally, in all of his works, reflects the idea that even though a person is accountable for his human failings, he is usually not accountable to other human beings who have also human failings. The Rambam and his family fled their ancestral city of Cordova, and they were so frightened that the Almohad revolution would sweep Spain that they were not satisfied to move to other communities in Spain. But they left the Spanish peninsula, recrossed the Mediterranean, and settled in Morocco. When they came to the city of Fez in Morocco, a revolution of the Almohads broke out in Fez. And it's a little like what happened, unfortunately, to many Jews during the time of the Second World War. Before the Second World War, they fled from Germany, but they did not flee far enough. They fled to Holland, or they fled to France, or they fled to Belgium, and then a year later, they found themselves again in the grip of the Germans. So here, the Rambam and his family found themselves again in the midst of this terrible upheaval. They escaped from Fez, and they moved to the Atlas Mountains in Morocco and lived in a cave. It's not clear whether they lived there 7 years or 9 years, but for a long period of time. And this event of the Almohads, they never recovered from it. Just as people that underwent the terrible experiences of the Second World War, many people never recovered, even though they built for themselves lives later, etc. It's of such a tremendous traumatic nature that people don't get over it. And the Rambam never got over it all of his life. We'll see later in the Rambam's attitude towards Islam and his attitude towards the Quran is reflected a personal animosity, because to a great extent they were responsible for the death of his parents, and as we will see, the Rambam had what could certainly be considered a tragic life. His first wife died when they were young. He had children who died. His parents died. His brother, his beloved brother, died on him. And the Rambam felt that the root of the problem was in the fact that they were always exiles, they were always uprooted, and that they always had the terror of the Almohads hanging over their heads. During the period of time that the Rambam was in the cave, he wrote the first of his three great works. The literary accomplishments of the Rambam are just indescribable. But there are three major works of the Rambam that we have. Any one of those volumes by itself would be enough to guarantee him immortality. But the three together raise him to the level of being unbelievable. And this book, the Rambam called it the Sefer HaMo'or, the Book of Light. We know it as the Rambam's commentary to the Mishnah, the Pirush HaMishnayos LaHaRambam. Now the Rambam in the Pirush HaMishnayos, and don't forget, he's a young man, the book was published when he was 24, when he came to Cairo. The Rambam did many new and innovative things. Number one, he wrote it in Arabic, the first book of commentary of halacha that is written in the vernacular tongue, not written in Hebrew or Aramaic, but it was written so that it could be read by the masses and not merely by the scholars, because in the time that we are speaking about, the Ashkenazim are different. We're going to talk about the Ashkenazim next year. But the Sfardim in Spain, in Morocco, throughout the Arab world, they spoke, read, and dealt in Arabic. That was the language, much as we deal in English. In the synagogue, the prayers and the ritual naturally were in Hebrew, but Hebrew was not the spoken language. And in fact, the Sephardim developed for themselves, a new language called Ladino, which is Spanish, Arabic, and Hebrew. And Jews throughout the ages, and we are slowly doing that to English also, Jews throughout the ages transform the language of the country that they are living in, and they Hebraicize it or Judaize it. Yiddish is the prime example. And basically, it's a dialect of German which was taken over and made Jewish. Ladino is Arabic, Spanish, taken over and transformed into Hebrew inflection and Hebrew idiom, and it became, and it remains in many parts of the world, the language of the Sephardic Jew. But the Rambam wrote the Pirush HaMishnayos in Arabic. Now, he wrote it in Arabic with Hebrew letters, which is exactly what happened to Yiddish later. It's written in Hebrew letters, not written in the Arabic script, but written in Hebrew letters. I have here, a photograph of the Rambam's own handwriting, the original copy, which is in extant, and it was in a synagogue in Syria, and microfilms were made of it, and therefore we still have it. The synagogue was burned down in 1948 when the State of Israel was declared. In that synagogue also was the oldest known copy of the Hebrew Bible, dating back to the 7th century, which also was burned, along with priceless other objects. But in the Jewish world, that's the way the ball bounces. In any event, another innovation, great innovation, in the Pirush HaMishnayos, is that the Rambam, here it is, I'll pass it around. You'll see the Rambam's handwriting. The language is Arabic, the script is Hebrew. For those people who are receiving the tapes, you'll just have to wait for the video. The Rambam, by the way, authorized later official translations of his Arabic work into Hebrew. And the Rambam, in fact, had a family, the Ibn Tibbon family, who lived in southern Spain, who were his official translators. So the Pirush HaMishnayos that we haven't published in the back of our Gemaras is a translation from the original Arabic. There is, in our time, a new translation by a Yemenite scholar, Rabbi David Kapach in Jerusalem, has been produced, and together with the text of the original script of the Rambam. The second thing that he did is that he provided introductions. This is a Pirush HaMishnayos. It's a commentary to the 6 sections of the Mishnah, but the Rambam provided introductions to each of the sections, and also introductions many times to certain chapters of the Mishnah. Those introductions themselves have been taken and collected as a book because of the fact that the introductions of the Rambam represent today the basic theology, so to speak, of the Jewish people. Now, Judaism is not big on theology. We really don't have much to say about God, because we don't know much about Him, and He doesn't share His secrets with us. So Judaism is basically a matter of halacha. It's a matter of dealing with mitzvahs and dealing with human beings. You'll go through the entire Talmud, you will find very little what can be called theology, of what can be called theology. It's almost non-existent. And not only that, there are wide divergences in opinion as to what Jewish theology is. For instance, our quarrel with Reform and Conservative Judaism is not a theological quarrel. It's simply a quarrel regarding the non-acceptance of halacha as being the basic rules by which the game is played. But in matters of theology, it's very hard for us to come to any definitive statements. There's a famous aphorism from Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, in which he said in the 1850s, he said that the difference between Judaism and Christianity is that Christianity is a religion invented by man to describe God, and Judaism is a religion invented by God to describe man. It's a little glib, but it does state the point. The point is, as the Talmud says regarding the verse in the prophet Jeremiah, so the Navi says, Osi Ozvu, they have forsaken me. So the Talmud comments, Halavai Osi Ozvu. It's okay, I mean, I don't care that they don't talk about me. Vitorosi Shomaru, as long as they observe the Torah, as long as they are decent human beings, as long as they are doing the 613 mitzvahs, I don't care that they don't have a course about God. In fact, it's better off. I think we're far better off not knowing about God. God gives us a headache. We can't understand them anyway. So therefore, until the time of the Rambam, even though there were Jewish philosophical works, such as the Book of Beliefs and Opinion, the Amunas Videos of Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon that we discussed, and other Jewish philosophic works, there was really no theology of Judaism. The Rambam came and invented a theology of Judaism. He felt it was necessary. He felt it was necessary because of the competition from the Christians. The Christians are muscle-bound. I mean, they're dogmatic. They are, especially medieval Christianity, is just tied up in knots in theology. And the Muslims also did that. And the Jews felt lonely, forsaken, that they did not have such a set of beliefs. Therefore, for instance, the 13 principles of faith, which are known to us, the Ani Mamins, I believe in perfect faith, and that pious Jews recite after the morning prayers, that is taken from the introduction, one of the introductions of the Rambam in his Pirush HaMishnayos. And the Rambam came and said, there are these 13 principles of faith. For the next 2-3 centuries, there would be strong dispute whether those were actually the 13 principles of faith or not. But the Rambam's influence was so great that he prevailed. So that today, it would almost be heretical for somebody to stand up and say, well, maybe not, or maybe that's not a principle of faith, or maybe that's wrong. The Rambam's influence is so great that the matter is settled simply because he said it. But in his time when he formulated and published those 13 principles of faith, that was revolutionary. And it did bring about a reaction. You know that anything that happens in Jewish life, be it positive or even less than positive, will bring about a strong reaction. And the more innovative, in fact, even the more positive it is, the stronger the reaction. And the Rambam is, in his lifetime, and for a century after his death, one of the most controversial figures in the history of the Jewish people. From about the year 1400 on, the Rambam reigns supreme. So that, let's say, in the last 600 years, there is no source of controversy regarding the Rambam. He's been accepted everywhere. But that was not the facts of the matter. Those were not the facts of the matter at the time that it occurred. A third innovation in the Pirush HaMishnayos is that the Rambam combined in the study of the Mishnah the practical halacha, the halachic conclusion to be drawn. In other words, I hope we will see when we discuss Rashi in the next series, Rashi is the greatest commentator that we have. Rashi is the man that explains everything, takes us by the hand, leads us through the jungle, which the thickets, that otherwise we'd be unable to study the Mishnah or the Talmud. But Rashi never tells us what the halacha is. Rashi never tells us what we're supposed to do with it. Rashi just explains it. The Rambam not only explained in the Pirush HaMishnayos, the Rambam already showed what eventually would be his magnus opus. The Rambam eventually already showed that he wanted to say what the law is. So that if someone had his book, the book would not only be a scholarly work, a commentary, the book would be a practical book. The book would be a guidebook to life. You would know what the halacha is, and you would know what to follow and how to behave. The Rambam came to what is today the city of Cairo, Al-Fayyum. He wanted to escape from the Almohads. He wanted to escape from all of the persecution that he was afraid of. He really wanted to get as far away from Spain as he could. And therefore he moved east, and he came to Cairo. He came to Egypt. Now here we have the problem that Jews are not supposed to live in Egypt. Three times in the Torah it says that Jews should not go back to Egypt. So there are different interpretations, whether it's this Egypt, and what does it mean they're not supposed to stay there, etc., etc. I don't want to discourage the Egyptian tourist business. It's the latest rage in bar mitzvahs to have, you know, the kid recite from the Sphinx his haftorah. But the Rambam felt compelled to live in Egypt. And he would live there the balance of his life, the next 45 years. But the Rambam felt it was wrong. And on a number of letters that the Rambam was a tremendous correspondent. On a number of letters that he wrote to Jews in France, in Spain, and in Iraq, and in Syria, he signed the letter, Anochi Moshe ben Maimon Hasfardi, I, Moses, the son of Maimon from Spain, over bechol yom b'shlosha lavin, who every day transgresses upon three commandments in the Torah, the three commandments being not to live in Egypt. So the Rambam felt that compelled to live in Egypt, but he did not have an easy conscience regarding it. Now, that's a very good question. The Rambam did not go farther than Egypt. It apparently was his aim to go to the Holy Land. But the Rambam, this is the time of the Third Crusade. And in fact, the emperor in Egypt is the famous Salah ad-Din, who defeated Richard the Lionhearted and ended the Christian crusader kingdom in Palestine. And the country was in ruins. The Jewish community was in ruins. It was a tremendous danger to live in the country. Because the Jews, no matter who won the Crusades, the Jews lost it. And therefore the Rambam did not proceed farther than Cairo. When he came to Cairo, he began to practice medicine. We have a number of medical works of the Rambam in dermatology, in pharmacology, and also in anatomy. Much of it is amazing, considering that we're talking about the 12th century. Much of it is the 12th century. There is an institute in Israel that has republished in English the works of the Rambam in medicine. I can only say that the works of the Rambam in Halacha are far more popular. But in his day, the Rambam had a reputation as a great physician. And his reputation reached into the halls of the king. And the king made him the official physician, the house physician for his harem. Since he had a very large harem, and because of him there always were medical activities going on, the Rambam was a very busy doctor. And in many of the letters that he writes, he describes to us the pressures of time. Also, you could not, I mean, if the king didn't like you, he wasn't going to file a malpractice suit against you. You would get killed. So that tension, and many times that happened, you know, they would prescribe medicine for the king wouldn't take it, he wouldn't feel well, he'd kill the doctor. Which may have merit to it, but it's not really fair. And therefore the Rambam writes about that also, about the medical pressures upon him. We have a famous letter that the Rambam wrote describing his typical day, in which he describes how he gets up before dawn and how he works at his studies and at his books and at prayer, and then he goes to the court and he spends the whole day till the middle of the afternoon tending to the medical needs there in the court, and then he has people from all over the world that come to interview him and to talk to him. And how at the end of the day, going home, he is so tired that his servant has to lift him to place him upon the donkey. And the donkey goes by itself home, and he barely makes it. When you read about the Rambam's day, it is even more mind-boggling, the literary accomplishments, because of the time, as you see, from the time to write all of this. To think it, to organize it, to write it. During the Rambam's middle years, we have the great work of his called the Mishnah Torah, the repetition of the Torah, or as it is also called, the Yad HaChazoka, the strong hand. Yad is a play on words also. It is the Yud Dalid is the number 14, and the work is in 14 volumes, 14 sections. The Yad HaChazoka is the encyclopedia of Jewish halacha, of Jewish tradition, from A to Z. And it includes everything that is in the Babylonian Talmud, in the Palestinian Talmud, in the Midrashim, you name it, it's all in there. And it is organized into to perfection. The Rambam's system of organization is so perfect that later generations were able to deduce what the Rambam meant simply by seeing where he put the law, under what paragraph, under what heading. How did the Rambam look at it? Then you have an insight as to what he wanted, where he placed it. The Orach HaZokah is also a revolutionary book. The Orach HaZokah he wrote in Hebrew. Classic Mishnaic Hebrew. There is no Hebrew that equals the Hebrew of the Rambam. In clarity, in conciseness, in beauty. Everyone who quotes the Rambam in later generations says, with his golden pen, his golden language. Secondly, and perhaps even more importantly, the Rambam did not give us any footnotes. The Rambam did not make any references to any books that preceded him, with the exception of the Torah itself, when he quotes a verse in the Torah. And when he quotes the verse in the Torah, he doesn't tell you where it is either. He just quotes it. Now here, you have a law book, so to speak, that is organized into 14 volumes. Every volume has sections, subsections. Within the subsections, there are paragraphs. Within the paragraphs, there are subparagraphs. Where did he get it from? How did he arrive at that conclusion? What is the support for his statement? The Rambam did not give us a clue. Later in his life, before his death, he wrote that if he had to do it over again, he would not do it that way. And that he would bring the sources. There's an interesting story that the Rambam tells himself, that a great rabbi from Baghdad came and asked him regarding one certain question in halacha, where did the Rambam take that? And the Rambam said that he thought it was in Maseches Sanhedrin. He thought it was in Tractate Sanhedrin. The Rambam writes this. He says, and they looked all through to tractate, and they couldn't find it. So then the Rambam says, well, it must be a Maseches Makos. And they looked through all Maseches Makos, and he couldn't find it. So the rabbi said to him, see, I told you should have written, you can't find yourself. So the Rambam writes there that I felt very badly. And the rabbi left. The moment he left, I remembered, he says, that it is brought as an aside in Maseches Yevamos, and I sent a messenger immediately to tell him where the source is, but he says, I now realize, he says, now I'm old, the Rambam says, I'm old, so I can't remember everything. He said, but when I did it, I should have put out a book with all the sources. The Rambam's son, Rabbeinu Avraham ben Rambam, wrote such a book of all of his father's sources. That book was also destroyed. It was burned in one of the many wild pogroms that took place in Egypt a century after the death of the Rambam. So that book we don't have. And till today, therefore, one of the great gains, so to speak, of Jewish scholarship is, where did the Rambam take this from? How did he arrive at this conclusion? The Rambam said regarding his book, and this is our God's irony, God's sense of humor, the Rambam said, he who has my book will need no other book of Jewish scholarship. In the history of man, there is no book that has spawned as many other books upon it as the Rambam's Mishneh Torah. there are over 10,000 volumes that have been written of commentary regarding the Rambam's work. And I just last year, I tried to check it out. The little that I checked out, over 300 new books were written based upon the Rambam. So, aside from being the book to end all books, it is the book that has spawned more books than any other book, not only in the Jewish world, any other book in the world. I'm certain that there's no other book in the world that has that type of attention paid to it. The Rambam also included in this book of Halacha the first section, which is called the Sefer Hamado, the Book of Knowledge, in which the Rambam established and reestablished his theology of Judaism and many of his philosophic viewpoints. The Rambam, for instance, deals with the great problem that troubles all philosophers. If God is omniscient, as we say he is, that God knows everything in advance, he knows what a person is going to do, then how can we say that a person has free will or freedom of choice? It is predestined, because since God knows in advance what he's going to do, and God cannot be wrong by definition, that's being omniscient, so therefore the person has no freedom of choice. And the Rambam explains that that's a question only based upon our semantics and our logic, but that God's foreknowledge is not really an influence in our choice. But the Rambam then has a discussion about the attributes of the Ribbono Shel Olam, the godly attributes, and about other purely what we would call theological matters. Because of that, this volume of the Mishneh Torah, the volume that's called the Sefer Hamado, is the most controversial volume in the book. And I'll discuss with you later that this volume was burned at the stake by Jewish fanatics who felt that the Rambam was incorrect and that somehow the cure to being incorrect is to burn it. The Rambam deals with all of the philosophic questions there. Can God create a wheel that is so large that even he cannot turn it? Famous philosophic quandary. All of the problems of logic, etc., are introduced into this book, into the book of Halacha. The Rambam also has a detailed section on astronomy. Jewish astronomy is based on the fact that the earth is a sphere. That was well known in the Jewish world from the beginning. The Rambam also adopted, however, a great deal of Aristotelian astronomy, much of which was later disproved by Copernicus and other astronomers, modern astronomy, as to the nature of the heavens. All of this is included in the book. The book is the magnum opus of Jewish scholarship. There's no book that approaches it. And it has been reprinted hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, and almost no Jewish home or Jewish scholar can exist without it. just to show you the influence of the book, one of the Rambam's critics, the Rambam had a in southern France, in Provence, there is a section, a village called Lunil, from the word lunar, meaning the moon. And the people who live there call themselves Hayarchi, from the word Yoreach, the moon. The Jews did that very often. They took the French name and they Hebraicized it. And they were called the Chachmei Lunil, the wise men of Lunil. And they were tremendous supporters of the Rambam. And they engaged in a correspondence that lasted 25 years with the Rambam, asking him questions, asking him to explain things that he wrote. He wrote back to them. When the controversy arose regarding the Rambam, so one of the zealots who opposed the Rambam wrote them a letter, and he said, "I heard a terrible thing about your yeshiva in Lunil. I heard that when you have a question that you don't understand and you want to look it up in the Rambam, so you say, bring the Urim V'Tumim. Bring the breastplate of the high priest so that we can look at it." In other words, that they call the Rambam Sefer the Urim V'Tumim. So Rabbi Yonasan HaKohen Milunil, the head of the yeshiva, wrote him back and he said, "You heard falsely. When we refer to the Rambam, we say, bring the Oren Kodesh. Bring the Ark of the Law, where the Torah resides." And ferocity and tenacity of the supporters of the Rambam is a testament to the book. In our time, the book needs no testaments. Any book that has survived 800 years of scholarly investigation and remains the basic book of law that no one can deal with without it, so that is the greatest testimony to it. But you have to have an appreciation of what was involved. As I mentioned to you, the Rambam in his personal life that was widowed early, and that his two children from his first wife died in a plague, and that he had a brother, David, who was a world-famous businessman, merchant of the time, and who apparently helped sustain the Rambam, and to whom he was bound with an emotional bond all of his life. His brother David was lost at sea in a storm, and the Rambam all of his life grieved over these tragedies. And he writes in his letters that if it would not be for his scholarship, if it would not be for Torah, he would be unable to continue. The Rambam did remarry, and he had from the second marriage a son whose name was Avraham, Rabbeinu Avraham ben Arambam. Rabbeinu Avraham ben Arambam suffered the fate that many great children of great parents suffer. And that is that the father is so great that the son never gets out of his shadow, even though the son in his own right was an enormously great person and a genius and a scholar, etc. That is the fate of Rabbeinu Avraham ben Arambam. And he, in effect, devoted his entire life to defending his father, to clarifying his works, to republishing them, etc. And the Rambam's family exists among the Jewish people until today. There are a few thousand descendants from mostly Turkish Jewry who claim direct lineal descent from the Rambam. And the family name Maimon is well known among Sephardic Jewry And needless to say, that's a tremendous badge of honor. One last thing tonight, before next week we'll continue. We'll have the second and final lecture on the Rambam. As I mentioned to you, Saladin was the Arab leader, the Muslim leader that defeated the Christians and was able to throw them out of Palestine. The Rambam had influence with Saladin. In fact, Saladin so treasured the Rambam that he appointed the Rambam as the president of the Jewish community in Egypt, the Nagid, which was an official post. So added to, imagine, not just being the rabbi to Shul, but being the president as well. And the Rambam was able, therefore, to obtain from Saladin many political favors for the Jews in Palestine and the Jews in the Muslim world generally. And he was able to modify the hold of the fundamentalists, the hold of the strict interpretation of the Quran, which would have forced terrible times upon the Jews. So the Rambam's influence in the Jewish world was not only because of his scholarship and not only because of his literary works, but also because of his political influence and his diplomatic abilities in being able to communicate to the head of the Muslim world the fact that the Jews should be left alone. And the great Jewish Egyptian community from the time of the Rambam, again, till our time, was based upon the foundations that the Rambam laid for it 800 years ago. When you go to Cairo today, they show you the Rambam Shul, etc., as one of the tourist sites. The influence of the Rambam upon Egyptian Jewry was very profound, long-lasting, and as I mentioned to you, he established the infrastructure of that Jewry as it remained until today.
This concludes the lecture on Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon by Rabbi Beryl Wein. For information, please contact the Destiny Foundation at 1-800-499-WINE. That's 1-800-499-9346, or at our 24-hour fax number, 845-356-7733. We can also be reached by email at info@jewishdestiny.com. Shop online at www.jewishdestiny.com. Due to copyright laws, we kindly request that there be no duplication of this tape except through the Destiny Foundation.